Good morning. I'm Maeve Conran, and coming up on today's Morning Magazine, we'll hear about the role that a small town in Colorado played in efforts to electrify our modern grid. Then, a Boulder theatre company will be working later this spring with a group of kids on a series of workshops where they're going to create their own version of George Orwell's Animal Farm. We'll hear more later in the Morning Magazine. On Resistance Radio, we'll hear about ongoing resistance to policies and laws that criminalise homelessness and poverty in cities along the Front Range. After headlines from the BBC, we'll get a new commentary from Jim Hightower. Then on A Public Affair this morning, the Community Foundation of Boulder County hosts a discussion on LGBTQ issues in the county. At 9 o'clock, it's the latest edition of Counterspin, bringing us a media analysis. Then at 9:30, we'll start a morning of music on the Morning Sound Alternative. But first, at 5 minutes past 8 o'clock, we'll begin with the latest local headlines. Here's Jamie Sudler.
A movement of sorts is underway to recall Colorado Governor Jared Polis. Nearly 30,000 people have joined a Facebook page urging his removal. The website describes its disagreements with the governor over his signing of the popular vote bill, which, if approved by enough other states, would require Colorado Electoral College members to vote for the presidential candidate who received the most votes nationally. They also complain that Senate Bill 181, which would overhaul the way oil and gas is regulated in the state, has been fast-tracked. The group points additionally to the red flag bill that would allow a judge to remove weapons from a person who poses a risk to themselves or others. The Greeley Tribune reports that one of the administrators of the Facebook page is Shane Donnelly, who at one time wrote in a post that Hitler was good to the German people. Tom Good, who is a registered agent for one fundraising group for Polis' recall, said that there's currently no involvement of the Colorado Republican Party in the effort, and he plans to keep it that way. Kyle Saunders, a political science professor at CSU, told the Tribune that he credits this kind of movement to a rise in populism worldwide, which has been accompanied by more distrust than ever in social institutions. And on the subject of the national popular vote bill, hundreds of voters gathered in Grand Junction on Saturday to sign petitions to put the issue to voters on the 2020 ballot. The governor signed it into law on March 15. Colorado joined 11 other states and the District of Columbia to commit its electoral votes to the winner of the national popular vote, but that law would not go into effect until enough states representing 270 electoral votes passed similar measures. The Grand Junction Daily Sentinel reports that the effort to place the issue on the ballot is led by Mesa County Commissioner Rose Pugliese and the mayor of the town of Monument, Don Wilson. One of the organizers said that about 125,000 signatures are needed to put the question on the ballot. In news from the legislature, the red flag bill was passed on Friday in the state Senate, with debate stretching late into the night. As noted, the measure would allow law enforcement, a family member, or a household member to petition a judge to remove a person's firearms deemed to be a risk to themselves or others. The Denver Post reports that the debate of the bill occurred for almost 12 hours and was passed after state highway patrol officers were sent out to search for 5 Republican senators who had left the Capitol building. Ultimately, a deal was forged to proceed with the debates and end the search for the missing senators and instead mark them absent. The vote on the bill was along party lines, and a final vote in the Senate could occur early next week. It will then return to the House for a vote on minor changes. Union representatives and King Soopers management met this weekend, and talks continued early into this morning. Union members have already overwhelmingly approved a strike, but have not set a date for it to begin. KDVR reports that the president of the United Food and Commercial Workers Local 7 said both sides are still far apart. On its Facebook page, the union said early this morning that talks were still going on and earlier said that the company's most recent offer failed to address basic concerns of its members and took about $4 million off the table that had been in the company's prior offers. In a statement, King Soopers said that the union has provided a proposal that continues to be unrealistic and non-competitive for the Colorado market. The last workers' strike at King Soopers and City Market stores in Colorado was in 1996. The city of Boulder has joined an effort to demand that the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency withdraw its proposal to weaken federal limits on greenhouse gas emissions from coal-fired plants. The state of California is leading a coalition that includes 19 states and the District of Columbia, as well as leaders of cities and counties. Under the EPA's proposal, a new coal-fired plant would be able to emit 35% more carbon dioxide than it could under current law. In a news release, the city said that that climate change and the health effects of carbon pollution are urgent threats, and the EPA cannot be allowed to move forward to weaken coal plant emissions. Patchy fog today is supposed to end by about 9 this morning, giving way to sunny skies and a high of 57 with an overnight low of 32. Tomorrow, sunny with the high around 70, and right now it's about 39 along the Front Range. For KGNU, I'm Jamie Sudler.
It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock. Thomas Edison became a household name for inventing the first practical incandescent light bulb. But because of what happened in a small town in Colorado, his bitter rival Nikola Tesla won the bigger prize to electrify our modern grid. Well, over a century later, could revenge be in the offing? H2O Radio reports.
In the late 1800s, a battle was raging in the U.S. over how we were going to get our energy. It was a contest that about a century later inspired the rock band AC/DC. The War of the Currents, as it was called, was between Thomas Edison, who backed direct current, or DC, and Nikola Tesla, who was promoting something different, alternating current, or AC. Without getting too far into the weeds, the main difference between the two is the way the electrons move. DC travels in only one direction, and AC reverses direction at regular intervals. But one of the most important differences at the time was that AC could be transmitted long distances, an advantage that would prove decisive. Suffice it to say, there was a lot at stake over which system was going to electrify the nation, and at times it got a bit ugly, with Edison launching what today we might call fake news by doing things like electrocuting animals with AC to try to prove its dangers. Tesla, meanwhile, had teamed up with entrepreneur George Westinghouse, who saw electrification as an enormous business opportunity and had purchased Tesla's patents. The high-stakes war ended with a victory in, of all places, Telluride in southwest Colorado. Back around 1885, mines were a huge industry in the state, and they were starting to fail because they lacked a power source to operate. Nearby forests had been cleared for fuel, and the cost to bring in coal by burros was way too expensive.
The Gold King mine had a lot of mine left in it, but it wasn't feasible anymore with the production costs that they were having to pay.
I'm standing with Michael Rains, who works at the Ames Hydroelectric Plant just south of Telluride, and the Gold King mine he mentioned is not the same one near Durango, which had the devastating spill into the Animas River a few years ago. The owners of the Telluride mine, which also had a river nearby, thought they could save it by using hydropower if only they could get the electricity the 2 miles up the mountain. So they approached Westinghouse to try out Tesla's idea for alternating current. Tesla himself did not go to Telluride. Westinghouse sent a team of engineers to Colorado to install a generator based on his designs. On the 19th of June, 1891, they flipped the switch and sent electricity along newly constructed transmission lines up to the Gold King. The engineers were so amazed and nervous that it worked that they didn't turn it off for 30 days. When they did turn it off and back on again, it continued to work, and the Ames plant made history as the first hydroelectric facility to generate and transmit alternating current for industrial purposes in the U.S.
Proving to the world that AC was a viable option, and shortly after, the same design of the plant was built on a much larger scale at Niagara Falls, and it kick-started the grid as we know it today.
So the rest was history, and alternating current won. Or did it?
Almost everything in your home is actually using direct current. Your computer, your cell phone has a battery in it. It's using direct current. Your television is using direct current because it's full of electronics inside.
That's Stephen Frank, a researcher with the National Renewable Energy Lab near Golden, Colorado. He explains that the advent of the transistor in the 1950s opened the door for power electronics that help convert electricity for use in numerous devices we use today. That white cube that plugs into the wall to charge your phone? It's a power electronic converting AC to DC. But every time those conversions happen, from switching on lights to running a washing machine, energy is lost in the form of heat, something you probably don't want in the middle of summer. And given that you might flip on an air conditioner to cool down a building warmed up from multiple appliances, conversions are wasting electricity. So because our infrastructure is still running on AC, but a lot of end use is DC, Frank and his colleagues are doing much research on direct current technology to save energy, especially in buildings.
In the aggregate, we're talking about maybe being able to save 5 to 10% of all of the electricity that we consume in this country, roughly the amount of electricity that the state of Oregon uses in a year.
But there may be an even more compelling reason to incorporate more direct current into the grid: the surging sales of electric cars that need charging stations for their batteries. That's a trend and twist that might make fans of Edison smile, if not feel some vindication.
I find it deeply ironic that an electric car using battery storage and charging with fast DC chargers has Tesla's name on it.
For H2O Radio, I'm Franny Halperin.
It is 15 minutes past 8 o'clock. Well, George Orwell's Animal Farm might not seem like a usual fare for children's theatre troupe, but later this spring, a group of children in Boulder County will get the opportunity to create their own version of the play. It's a project of Centre Stage, a local children's theatre organisation, and it gives young performers the opportunity to create their own version of Animal Farm using their own life experiences. I spoke with Matt Klickstein, who will be working with the kids.
What we're going to do is the entire project, which does take a few months to enact, will be broken up into different stages. And the first will be one that I will be really leading and facilitating. We'll be doing a series of 10 workshops over the course of 10 Thursdays starting April 18th at the Center Stage facility in Louisville. For 2 hours, we'll be working with the children to develop their own characters and develop their own stories, preferably based on their own lives and personalities. So it will work very much like a television writer's room. I will literally be up front with a whiteboard and a marker, and we will talk about what kinds of things can happen in the play. What's the environment? Where is it taking place? Is it even taking place in the now? Is it taking place at an earlier stage? Is it taking place in the future? It is very challenging, even on a logistical level. For example, one of the people at Center Stage already asked me if we need to assign a music director. And I said, I don't know, because I don't know if the children are going to want to sing or not, or have music. That's really, I want to give as much agency to the children as possible. I'll really be there as an industry professional to make sure that they're staying on task and staying focused, that there's a good beginning, middle, and end, that there's development of the characters, but ultimately it'll be up to the children. And after we're done with the script, the children will then rehearse over the span of a couple of weeks in the summer, and then we're going to have performances throughout the area in September.
So this is going to be based on George Orwell's Animal Farm. So how true to the original play are you envisioning it will be?
Not very, to be honest. I've done this a few times before, most significantly when I was in Lawrence, Kansas a few years ago. I had wanted to do Lord of the Flies with a group of girls. But in working with the girls on Lord of the Flies, we realized for various reasons that we really needed to do and wanted to do our own original version of the play. And when we actually performed it, we didn't even call it Lord of the Flies. We called it Ladies of the Fly. And it was much more based, again, on their own experiences experiences and lives and personalities, but incorporated the themes and ideas and concepts of Lord of the Flies. And so I realized that was something that I really enjoyed helping to produce and wanted to do again. Now we're doing that with Animal Farm. So someone could very well see this and not even realize that Animal Farm was incorporated at all, but we'll be dealing with some of those themes and ideas. And one of the reasons I chose Animal Farm is, as you said, it's not only a very potent text, but it's obviously quite timely, for good or ill, quite prescient. I mean, Orwell wrote this in the late 40s, early 50s. And so to perform it today, I think, has a lot of power because there's so many elements of the themes and motifs of the book that I think we can really play with here. So it really will not be an Animal Farm performance, but it will incorporate some of the ideas from Animal Farm, which frankly are quite universal. I think that's why it's a book that we keep looking at over and over again, as we do with so much of Orwell's work, especially 1984.
Well, the kids who'll be part of this, they're going to be ages 8 through 14. So some of them possibly have heard of Animal Farm, but certainly the younger kids, I doubt they have. So how much are you going to talk about the themes? And particularly, as you said, it's very of the now right now, politically,
absolutely,
in terms of some of those themes that Orwell wrote about.
Yes. Well, for one, I know that our children now are much more aware of what's going on in society. They are much more locked into what's going on in the media. And I think that they have a much better understanding of what's happening in the political spectrum just because it's so ubiquitous now. They can't help it. While they're playing their video games on their phones or whatever it might be, there are ads coming in and notifications and whatnot. So I think children now are much more aware than they might have been in earlier generations. So I think they will very easily understand some of the concepts that we'll be talking about and discussing. Two, something that a lot of people don't realize is Animal Farm is a little different than some of Orwell's other work in that it is so readable, even for younger people. And that was not an accident. Originally, the subtitle was A Fairy Story. It was Animal Farm, A Fairy Story, because it really was indeed meant for children when Orwell first wrote it. He wanted it to be something along the lines of Alice in Wonderland or stories of that ilk, because he wanted everybody, proletarian and elite alike, to be able to understand the concepts he was dealing with. I mean, at the end of the day, it's a story about talking animals. And two, so not only do I think we'll be able to talk about some of those issues very easily with children, there is a fantastic animated film that was made in the mid-50s, very shortly after the book came out, that is quite close to the original text. I've watched it. I've analyzed it. I even deconstructed it in a class once many years ago. I trust it very wholeheartedly. There's a difference at the end that we'll actually discuss, which is kind of interesting. It has a slightly different ending, but we will watch that film together and discuss it. So the kids will have an opportunity to really get into Animal Farm. And number three is I happen to know some of the children that will probably be involved in this, sons and daughters of friends of mine, and many of them are reading Animal Farm as we speak. So I know that it's something that's still being read in junior high schools and I think even some elementary schools around the area right now. So I don't have an issue with having to talk about Animal Farm with these kids. I think they'll get it. Assigned somebody, so we'll be talking to her soon too.
Perfect. Well, we will run that probably early next week. So
great.
Perfect timing. Okay. Hang on 1 sec. So Matt, just say your name a couple of times so I can set our level.
Matthew Klickstein. Klickstein, like Klickstein.
Klickstein. And in terms of your title for this particular thing with Center Stage, are you what's your exact title? I just want to make sure I identify you correctly.
Oh wow, I haven't even thought about that yet.
I guess, say you're with Center Stage.
Yeah, you could say with Center Stage. Okay. You can call me project director if you want.
Okay, well tell us about this, because this is really empowering kids. It's not just your traditional children's theatre camp where they come along and perform a play. The kids themselves are very much involved in this and they're crowdsourcing their own version of Animal Farm, which is a pretty potent political play. And these are kids aged 8 through 14. What does that mean to crowdsource this play? What's going to happen?
What we're going to do is the entire project, which does take a few months to enact, will be broken up into different stages. And the first will be one that I will be really leading and facilitating. We'll be doing a series of 10 workshops over the course of 10 Thursdays starting April 18th at the Center Stage facility in Louisville. For 2 hours, we'll be working with the children to develop their own characters and develop their own stories. preferably based on their own lives and personalities. So it will work very much like a television writer's room. I will literally be up front with a whiteboard and a marker, and we will talk about what kinds of things can happen in the play. What's the environment? Where is it taking place? Is it even taking place in the now? Is it taking place at an earlier stage? Is it taking place in the future? It is very challenging, even on a logistical level. For example, one of the people at Center Stage already asked me if we need to assign a music director. And I said, I don't know, because I don't know if the children are going to want to sing or not, or have music. That's really, I want to give as much agency to the children as possible. I'll really be there as an industry professional to make sure that they're staying on task and staying focused, that there's a good beginning, middle, and end, that there's development of the characters. But ultimately, it'll be up to the children. And after we're done with the script, the children will then rehearse over the span of a couple of weeks in the summer. And then we're going to have performances throughout the area in September.
So this is going to be based on George Orwell's Animal Farm. So how true to the original play do you expect, or do you require that the kids keep to, you know, how true to the original play are you envisioning it will be?
Not very, to be honest. I've done this a few times before, most significantly when I was in Lawrence, Kansas a few years ago. I had wanted to do Lord of the Flies with a group of girls. But in working with the girls on Lord of the Flies, we realized for various reasons that we really needed to do and wanted to do our own original version of the play. And when we actually performed it, we didn't even call it Lord of the Flies. We called it Ladies of the Fly. And it was much more based, again, on their own experiences and lives and personalities, but incorporated the themes and ideas and concepts of Lord of the Flies. And so I realized that was something that I really enjoyed helping to produce and wanted to do again. Now we're doing that with Animal Farm. So someone could very well see this and not even realize that Animal Farm was incorporated at all. But we'll be dealing with some of those themes and ideas. And one of the reasons I chose Animal Farm is, as you said, it's not only a very potent urtext, but it's obviously quite timely, for good or ill, quite prescient. I mean, Orwell wrote this in the late 40s, early 50s. And so to perform it today, I think, has a lot of power because there's so many elements of the themes and motifs of the book that I think we can really play with here. So that it really will not be an Animal Farm performance, but it will incorporate some of the ideas from Animal Farm, which frankly are quite universal. I think that's why it's a book that we keep looking at over and over again, as we do with so much of Orwell's work, especially 1984.
Well, the kids who will be part of this, they're going to be ages 8 through 14. So some of them possibly have heard of Animal Farm, but certainly the younger kids, I doubt they had. So how much are you going to talk about the themes, and particularly, as you said, it's very of the now right now politically.
Absolutely.
In terms of some of those themes that Orwell wrote about.
Yes, well, for one, I know that our children now are much more aware of what's going on in society. They are much more locked into what's going on in the media, and I think that they have a much better understanding of what's happening in the political spectrum, just because it's so ubiquitous now. They can't help it. While they're playing their video games on their phones or whatever it might be, their ads coming in and notifications and whatnot. So I think children now are much more aware than they might have been in earlier generations. So I think they will very easily understand some of the concepts that we'll be talking about and discussing. Two, something that a lot of people don't realize is Animal Farm is a little different than some of Orwell's other work in that it is so readable, even for younger people. And that was not an accident. Originally, the subtitle was a fairy story. It was Animal Farm, a fairy story, because it really was indeed meant for children when Orwell first wrote it. He wanted it to be something along the lines of Alice in Wonderland or stories of that ilk, because he wanted everybody, proletarian and elite alike, to be able to understand the concepts he was dealing with. I mean, at the end of the day, it's a story about talking animals. And two, so not only do I think we'll be able to talk about some of those issues very easily with children, there is a fantastic animated film that was made in the mid-50s, very shortly after the book came out, that is quite close to the original text. I've watched it. I've analyzed it. I even deconstructed it in a class once many years ago. I trust it very wholeheartedly. There's a difference at the end that we'll actually discuss, which is kind of interesting. It has a slightly different ending, but we will watch that film together and discuss it. So the kids will have an opportunity to really get into Animal Farm. And number three is I happen to know some of the children that will probably be involved in this, sons and daughters of friends of mine, and many of them them are reading Animal Farm as we speak. So I know that it's something that's still being read in junior high schools and I think even some elementary schools around the area right now. So I don't have an issue with having to talk about Animal Farm with these kids. I think they'll get it.
How do you think we're doing in terms of arts education for kids? Just as an aside, because I know there are quite robust programs here locally, but just overall, you know, we're dealing with cuts to education. Sure. and people barely affording, school districts, you know, barely hanging on. You know, do you think the arts is being sacrificed through all of that?
I'm glad you brought it up, and I can't help but put in a plug. We've actually been looking for some partner organizations. I was talking a little bit with some of the people at the Jaipur Literary Festival, for example, and a few others. I'm hoping, and maybe through this broadcast and some of the other press we're going to be getting, that we might be able to reach out more to organizations that would be interested in helping to fund this program. Because it is such a long process, the center stage does have to charge a fair amount. I mean, it's basically like a camping fee. So it's $550 for a child to go through this process, which even for some of my friends' kids, that's a lot of money for some of these families. So we're hoping we can reach out to organizations. And if anyone is interested who's at an organization that could help, please do get in touch with Center Stage, because we'd love to have some scholarships. Because really what I want more than anything is this to be an eclectic group of children. In fact, when I did my Lord of the Flies group, I really made sure that the kids were going back to school and finding fellow students who maybe wouldn't do something like this. Center Stage is a prestigious, great organization in this community. It's why I went to them first. It's why I'm so excited to partner with them. And they do have kind of a critical mass of kids that they usually work with. But I would love to get some kids who are maybe sitting in the back of the room or maybe normally wouldn't do something along these lines and could come and join us and to have this experience too, because I really want kids from all over the spectrum here, as we have all over the Boulder area, whether they're disadvantaged or maybe coming from special ed programs or whatever it might be. So I'm hoping that we can get other organizations to come in and help to fund some of those students who would normally maybe not get to do this. To answer your original question, though, I'm happy with the arts education in the community here. Again, a lot of my friends' kids are doing great things like frequent flyers, which is amazing. They're doing silk dancing and whatnot. I'm very involved at the Dairy Center. I love what they're doing. Many of my friends' kids are singing, playing piano, doing all different kinds of things that I never got to do when I was a kid. So it looks like it's going well, but I myself don't have children yet. And so I don't know for sure. I'm sure that there's still a lot that can be done and needs to be done, but it seems like it's going well. So I could be mistaken.
Well, Matt Klickstein will be leading those workshops where local children will get a chance to crowdsource their own version of George Orwell's Animal Farm. And you can find out more if you're interested in participating in that. But also, Matt Klickstein says they're also interested in partnering with some local organizations who are interested in helping young people in the arts. You can find out more about all of that at centerstagetheatrecompany.org. It's 8:22. You're listening to KGNU, and now it's time for Resistance Radio. Despite a recent court finding that camping bans are unconstitutional, local groups like Colorado Concern and Together Denver state their opposition to Initiative 300. Now, that is going to be on the upcoming May ballot for voters in Denver, and it's about the criminalization of homelessness. KGNU's Robin Ryan asked Denver Homeless Out Loud's spokesperson, Therese Howard, about her organization's longstanding challenge of protecting rights for the poverty-stricken.
It's my understanding that right to rest and right to survive, these are measures that have been introduced into the legislative agenda for a number of sessions, yet it's never gone to the floor for a vote.
Yes. So for the past 4 years, we've run the Right to Rest Act at the state capitol, and we had committee hearings for the bill all of those years, and every single year it has been voted down and not made it to the floor.
An Initiative 300 in Denver for voters this upcoming May, in just a couple of months, is a municipal version of this effort?
Yeah, so the Right to Survive Initiative, Initiative 300, is the same as the Right to Rest Act, and it is, like you said, a municipal initiative in Denver to protect the rights of folks in Denver. So it is a statewide and even more a nationwide issue, but we are trying to take what steps we can right here locally in Denver.
And everybody's on board with everybody being okay and housed, right? There's no opposition to this effort?
No, absolutely not. There is a great deal of opposition to the effort.
Can you tell me by whom and why they say they oppose?
Yeah, so the group that has officially signed on to oppose the initiative, they're calling themselves Together Denver. They are made up of all of the largest business associations, property associations, realtor associations in Denver. So that's who's doing this opposition, is the folks that are the most rich and powerful in this city right now, that are currently actively lobbying for the passage of camping bans and sit-lie laws and other criminalization measures, and that when this initiative to overturn those laws and protect our basic rights to survive came forward, all joined up into a group they called Together Denver to control public property. They control private property right now across the whole city as they continue to buy off land and privatize our city, and now they are trying to control public property and say that you can't be visibly poor in public sight.
I saw a group in opposition to Initiative 300 refer to a study in support of their claims and positions. From what I can gather of its arguments, and that's 25 pages of the arguments, and it was the folks over at Common Sense Policy Roundtable that were citing this report as reason for their opposition to the effort. And basically, it seems to say, if our poverty shows, there will be economic consequences. It's been produced by something called the REMI Partnership. The Common Sense Policy Roundtable folks are actually part of this REMI Partnership in conjunction with Colorado Concern, the Colorado Bankers Association, and the Colorado Association of Realtors. I took the liberty of looking at the board of directors at both Colorado Concern and the Roundtable. There's a little place called the National Institute for Money and Politics. One board has 9 members. The other board has 14 members. I have a total figure on what these people have spent politically. Would you like me to share?
Yes.
At Common Sense Policy Roundtable, the board of directors there have contributed a collective $2.6 million to influence politics. And
Yes.
I guess my question wants to be, what are the chances they're going to craft policy that makes sense for the commons?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's exactly right. It's folks like that who have bottomless incomes to invest in defending laws that they want to defend and in opposing laws they want to oppose and influencing politics. It's organizations like that that are shaping our laws, and the chances that they have real connection to the struggles of survival in our city is nothing. They do not understand the struggles that it takes to afford rent, to find places to work, to survive on the streets. So that's who's making our policies, is people that are completely disconnected from reality.
Have you observed any shift in these groups that oppose the right to rest and the right to survive since last year's Ninth Circuit court finding that camping bans are unconstitutional?
Unfortunately not. Unfortunately, across the nation, even in cities that are in the district of the Boise case, the Ninth Circuit, the cities are trying to find every excuse they can to ignore the court ruling, ignore that these camping bans are unconstitutional, and continue to fight to pass these laws and to keep these laws on the books. So, yeah, I mean, I think the opposition just puts more money into their fight against people's rights. We have to put more people power behind that and work even harder to ensure that the public knows what's really going on and why this is unconstitutional.
The biggest contributor there at $1.9 million is Jack Graham, apparently a former athletic director for the Colorado College System. He is also affiliated with a place called Two Trees Partners. And I was able to find out that Two Trees Partners had a fundraising event to benefit the homeless. I wasn't entirely thrilled to learn it was a polo tournament.
Oh, interesting.
I've been talking with Therese Howard from Denver Homeless Out Loud. For more information, you can visit the website righttosurvive.org. For KGNU, this is Robin Ryan.
And it's time now for the Resistance Radio calendar. Now we got a revolution. This Thursday, March 28th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at Blush and Blue on Colfax Avenue in Denver, a Smash the Patriarchy concert. This Women's History Month, there'll be a celebration of all of the women who have had the audacity to rise. Local women of colour, who are vocalists and instrumentalists that are nationally and internationally known, will be featured. I'm here to tell you about destruction. Also on Thursday, a screening and panel discussion of the new documentary film Blood Memory, a story of removal and return. It looks at the impacts of removing Native children from their families and putting them into foster and adoption with white families. It happens Thursday evening from 6 to 9:30 p.m. at the University of Denver, Sturm Hall, Lindsay Auditorium. There will be another screening of that documentary on Friday, March 29th, and that's at noon at the Adams County Justice Center, and that's at 1100 Judicial Center Drive in Brighton, Colorado. You can find out more information about those and other events in our Resistance Radio calendar. Just go to news.kgnu.org and click on Resistance Radio. It's not as simple as talking jive. And did you know that you can subscribe to a podcast of The Morning Magazine so you can listen to local news headlines, stories, features and interviews anytime? Just search for KGNU wherever you get your podcasts.